Welcome to The Deep Dive. We're the show that unpacks the careers of modern giants, looking at, the hidden gears behind their biggest hits and, well, the controversies that often follow them around.
And today, we're putting a really monumental filmography under the microscope. We're talking about the work of Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, the ultimate movie kid, right? The one who actually turned into this major auteur.
He really is. I mean, you could argue he's the single most influential director of his generation. He's got this unique style. It's a mix of graphic violence, sure, but also these long, witty, pop culture-heavy dialogues.
And all held together by that signature nonlinear storytelling. He completely broke the mold with that.
Exactly. So our mission today is to basically map out his whole career, starting, from the beginning, the video store days.
The non-traditional path, yeah.
Right. Then look at his style. What makes a Tarantino film a Tarantino film? His influence, not just directing, but producing, curating.
And exhibiting film, too, which is fascinating. And we have to tackle the controversies because they're a big part of his public image.
Absolutely. The public persona, the clashes, and hanging over all of it is this countdown. His plan to stop after 10 films.
It's a huge part of the narrative now. But before we dive into how he built all this, let's just quickly look at the sheer scale of it. The numbers are kind of staggering.
They really are. His films, collectively, have grossed over $1.9 billion worldwide. That's just huge.
That's blockbuster money, not what you typically expect from an indie auteur, right? But then you balance that against the critical acclaim.
Exactly. It's not just money. It's serious recognition. 2 Academy Awards for Best Original Screenplay, Pulp Fiction, Django Unchained.
Doopy BAFTAs as well.
And the big one, early on, the Palme d'Or at Cannes for Pulp Fiction. That really announced his arrival.
He went from indie darling to, critical heavyweight almost overnight and completely on his own terms.
Okay, so to really get Tarantino, you have to understand where he came from. It wasn't the usual system. He basically emerged from, a library of movies.
Born in Knoxville, Tennessee, right, March 27th, 1963.
Yeah, Quentin Jerome Tarantino. And his connection to pop culture was there from the start. He was partly named after Quint Asper, Burt Reynolds' character in Gunsmoke.
Huh, no way. And that famous self-taught film education. It's legendary now. He skipped film school.
He did. Yeah, it's hard to believe looking at his films, isn't it?
Right.
But he essentially made his own film school. That famous quote.
When people ask me if I went to film school, I tell them, no, I went to films.
Exactly. And that education happened in a couple of key places. First, he was an usher at the Pussycat Theater, an adult movie house, soaking up genre films, the raw stuff.
Right. And then the big one, Video Archives.
The crucial 5 years working at Video Archives in Manhattan Beach, that's where it all clicked.
5 years surrounded by tapes, recommending movies, arguing about them. That must have been like a fire hose of film knowledge.
Oh, totally. It wasn't just shelving videos. He and his friend Roger Avery, they were like curators. They'd championed obscure B-movies, foreign films, stuff nobody else was watching.
So he was developing that taste, seeing the art in genres others dismissed.
Yeah, soaking up visual styles, narrative tricks, dialogue rhythms. That video store, it basically became the source code for his whole aesthetic. It was his university.
But before Reservoir Dogs blew up, there were some early attempts, weren't there? Almost like myths now.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Raw efforts. His very first known script was apparently written when he was just 14, something called Captain Peachfuzz and the Anchovy Bandit.
Fantastic title.
Isn't it? But more importantly, there was the uncompleted film, My Best Friend's Birthday, from 87, shot on 16mm.
A lot of that got lost, right, in a fire.
Yeah, partially destroyed in a lab fire, sadly.
Right.
But some dialogue, some scenes, they survived. And he ended up folding bits of that into the script for True Romance. So even then, he was learning to recycle, repurpose his own ideas.
And the money to actually get going, the seed money, didn't come from some studio exec. It came from residuals.
From Elvis. Well, playing Elvis.
Yeah.
In 1988, he had this bit part as an Elvis impersonator on The Golden Girls.
The Golden Girls. Serious.
Yep. The episode Sophia's Wedding, Part 1, got paid maybe $650 up front. But the episode was popular, got rerun a lot.
Ah, so the residuals kept coming in.
Over the next 3 years, they added up to about $3,000. And that, plus the stuff salvaged from My Best Friend's Birthday, that was basically the pre-production fund for his first real feature script.
Which brings us to Reservoir Dogs, the breakthrough. And that script, apparently, he just churned it out.
3.5 weeks, legend has it. The script was just electric. He met producer Lawrence Bender, it got passed around.
Monty Hellman got involved. The director.
Yeah, Bender got it to Hellman, who helped secure some initial funding. But the absolute game changer was Harvey Keitel reading it.
Right. Keitel didn't just like it, he loved it.
Signed on immediately, agreed to act in it, and put money into the budget. That was huge. Having an established Oscar-nominated actor backing this unknown kid, that gave it instant credibility.
It made it more than just another low-budget indie. It had weight. So Reservoir Dogs hit Sundance in 92.
And suddenly, Tarantino, who wrote it, directed it, even acted in it as Mr. Brown.
He's like a virgin interpretation.
That guy. Suddenly, he's the hottest new voice in Hollywood. But what's interesting is, while he's doing this edgy indie stuff, he's also moonlighting.
As a script doctor, yeah.
Yeah.
On big studio movies.
That's the fascinating part. He did uncredited work polishing dialogue on huge films like Crimson Tide, The Rock.
So he's seeing how the big machine works from the inside.
Exactly. Learning about high-budget action filmmaking,
yeah.
But consciously choosing not to direct those kinds of films himself. He got offered massive projects, right? Speed, Men in Black.
And turned them down. Why? Control.
Pretty much. He prioritized his vision, his control over the material, instead of cashing in and directing, say, Speed.
He took his Reservoir Dogs money and went to Amsterdam.
Yep. Holed up and wrote Pulp Fiction. And when that came out in 1994, well, it wasn't just a movie. It was a phenomenon.
It completely changed indie film, didn't it? Cemented his style, the violence, the dialogue, and especially that fragmented, nonlinear structure.
Absolutely. And the success was insane. Over $200 million worldwide. Wins the Palme d'Or, gets him and Roger Avery the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. It proved you didn't need a straight line to tell a story that connected with a massive audience.
Okay, so let's dig into that style. From the video store origins to the actual cinematic signature, people call his work postmodern. What does that really mean for, like, a film like Pulp Fiction?
Well, yeah, he's obviously drawing heavily on film history. He's not creating in a vacuum.
Right, he's a massive film nerd.
Exactly. The postmodern part is really about the synthesis. He takes genres that were maybe looked down on, spaghetti westerns, blaxploitation, Hong Kong martial arts films, and he mashes them up, elevates them.
Like Sergio Leone's westerns, he talks about those a lot.
Huge influence. Once upon a time in the West, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But it's not just the gunfights he takes. It's that stretched out tension, the cool factor, the moral ambiguity.
And mixing that with, say, blaxploitation, what does that mashup achieve?
Okay, so blaxploitation films from the 70s, like The Mac or Foxy Brown, they had this specific energy, gritty, street level,
yeah.
Often focused on black antiheroes, super stylized.
Right.
So when Tarantino fuses the kind of Leone-esque cool and moral gray areas with the visual flair and attitude of blaxploitation, think Jackie Brown, he creates something new. It feels vintage, but also totally contemporary. He's picking the cool parts of film history and stitching them together.
And he pulls from everywhere, doesn't he? Hong Kong action, Sonny Chiba.
Oh, yeah. Cult figures.
Yeah.
He even championed obscure Filipino directors like Sergio H. Santiago, called him a personal icon.
And his admiration for other filmmakers like Brian De Palma, that led to casting Travolta, right?
Directly. He loved De Palma's blowout and saw something in Travolta that Hollywood had kind of forgotten,
yeah.
Which obviously paid off massively in Pulp Fiction.
And he has some surprising takes, too, like calling Jaws the greatest movie ever, not necessarily the best film.
Yeah, that distinction is interesting. It shows he values pure cinematic experience, the ride, maybe even over, you know, high art refinement sometimes. It's about impact.
So the influences are this rich tapestry, but the structure, that nonlinearity, that's maybe the most recognizable Tarantino effect.
It's more than just shuffling scenes around, though. It's deliberate. By shifting the timeline, he plays with how you understand the characters, their motivations. Information gets withheld, then revealed. It ramps up the tension.
You see someone die, then later you see what led up to it, which totally changes how you feel about them.
Exactly. You see it in Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, Kill Bill, Hateful Eight. It's a core tool for him.
And we know it's intentional because Tony Scott directed True Romance from Tarantino's script, but Scott made it linear.
Right. And it became this high-energy thriller, totally different vibe from what Tarantino probably intended, which was more character-focused. That linear True Romance is like the perfect contrast to his own directing style. For Tarantino, the structure is part of the theme.
Okay, structure aside, the dialogue is probably the other half of the equation.
Oh, absolutely. It's what makes it all work, arguably.
It's that mix of really mundane pop culture stuff right before or after something incredibly violent happens.
It grounds everything. You've got hitmen talking about burgers in France or gangsters debating Madonna lyrics.
A royale with cheese. like a virgin breakdown.
These hyper-real, trivial conversations make these often extreme characters feel weirdly human, relatable even. They argue about tipping, about foot massages. It makes the sudden shifts to violence even more jarring.
And that contrast is where his dark humor comes in, right?
Definitely. Which leads us to the violence itself. We have to talk about it. It's constant. It's graphic. It's always been controversial.
And he's always defended it, hasn't he? Famously saying.
Because it's so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
He argues his films are dramas, but they have this sense of humor that makes you laugh at unexpected, often uncomfortable moments.
Even though the body counts could be really high.
Oh, yeah. The data is pretty stark. Like, Reservoir Dogs had, what, 10 deaths, but over 400 profanities?
Yeah.
Django Unchained, fewer swear words, but like 47 deaths. The intensity is always there.
Another structural thing he does is build his own universe.
The Tarantino cinematic universe. Yeah, he's actually laid it out.
Two-tiered system, right.
Exactly. Tier one is the realer-than-real world. Films like Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, they exist in a reality pretty close to ours, just maybe a bit heightened.
Okay. And tier two?
Tier two is the movie universe. These are the films that the characters in tier one would actually go and watch.
So like Kill Bill or From Dusk Till Dawn are the kind of B movies Vincent Vega might watch.
Precisely. That explains why those films are even more stylized, more extreme. They're literally meant to be movies within his other movies.
Yeah.
It justifies the comic book visuals, the anime sequences in Kill Bill.
That's actually quite clever. And this extends to the product placement or lack thereof.
The fictional brands. Yeah. Big Kahuna Burger, Red Apple Cigarettes, Jackrabbit Slims.
Why do that? Just to avoid dating the films.
That's part of it, yeah. Keeps them timeless. But it also reinforces that self-contained universe. These brands pop up across different films, connecting them subtly. It makes his world feel more cohesive.
Okay, before we move on from style, we kind of mention the feet.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Feet. It's become this huge internet thing, hasn't it? The constant close-ups on bare feet.
He gets asked about it all the time. What's his take?
He tends to get defensive, dismisses it as just good direction, says other great directors did it too, Buñuel, Hitchcock, Sofia Coppola.
It does seem really prominent in his films compared to others, doesn't it?
I mean, yeah. The frequency and the specific framing, it feels like more than just coincidence. Whether it's a conscious fetish or just a recurring visual attack, it's definitely become one of his unmistakable signatures, maybe even a distraction for some viewers.
So a director with such a specific, intense style, they often need a loyal crew, right? People who just get it. Tarantino seems to have built his own kind of repertory company.
Oh, absolutely. That loyalty is key to the consistency. The most obvious example is Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, nobody delivers Tarantino dialogue quite like him.
He's been in, what, 5 films Tarantino directed, plus True Romance, which he wrote? 6 total. Knowing Jackson will deliver the lines lets Tarantino write specifically for that voice, that rhythm. It deepens the whole thing.
And then there's Uma Thurman, his muse.
Integral is the word. 3 films. But obviously, Kill Bill is the peak of that collaboration. They developed the bride character together. That partnership really shaped those two films entirely. Shows the trust involved.
But maybe the most amazing collaboration story recently, the one that really shows his impact, is Christoph Waltz.
Waltz is incredible. He was basically unknown in the U.S., working mostly in European TV for decades. Then Tarantino casts him as Hans Landa in Inglourious Basterds.
And boom! Oscar for Best Supporting Actor.
Instantly. And then he does it again a few years later for Django Unchained. Tarantino didn't just cast him. He saw this incredible talent nobody else stateside had tapped into and gave him this massive platform. Twice.
That loyalty extends behind the camera too, doesn't it? Especially in the editing room. Sally Mankey.
Sally Mankey. Her importance can't be overstated. She edited every single one of his films until she sadly passed away in 2010.
He called her his number one collaborator.
You did. And think about her job. Taking these non-linear scripts, often shot out of order, and making them flow, making them tense instead of just confusing. She was the architect, making those complex structures work so beautifully. Her loss was huge for his filmmaking process.
Now, thinking back to his video store roots, that love of film history wasn't just for his own movies. He actively tried to promote other films, right, as a curator.
Absolutely. That drive led him to set up Rolling Thunder Pictures back in 1995 with Miramax. The whole idea was to distribute or re-release indie and foreign films he loved, but that weren't getting seen.
Like Wong Kar-wai's Chungking Express, beautiful film.
Exactly, and exploitation stuff like Switchblade Sisters. He wanted to give these films a platform.
But it didn't quite take off commercially.
Sadly, no. The films got critical praise, but sales weren't great. And Miramax shut it down after a couple of years. But the impulse didn't die. He just shifted tactics.
Using his own name. The presented by Quentin Tarantino tag.
That became his new tool. And it was brilliant marketing. His name was a stamp of approval for audiences who trusted his taste.
It gave films mainstream attention they wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
Totally. He used it for stuff like Iron Monkey, a Hong Kong martial arts film, and most successfully, Zhang Yimou's Hero.
Hero opened at number one in the U.S., didn't it?
It did. Grossed over $50 million. All thanks to that, presented by Tag. He was leveraging his own fame to champion other people's work he believed in.
He even got involved in producing a documentary.
Yeah, Freedom's Fury, in 2006. It's about that insane blood-in-the-water water polo match between Hungary and the Soviet Union at the 56 Olympics, right after the Hungarian uprising.
Politically charged story.
Incredibly. Tarantino heard about it, was captivated, said it was the best story he'd ever heard, and wanted to help get it made. His name helped secure funding and distribution.
And finally, his most literal commitment to film, buying theaters.
This is like the ultimate film preservationist move, isn't it? In 2010, he bought the New Beverly Cinema in L.A.
And made that pledge.
As long as I'm alive and as long as I'm rich, the New Beverly will be there, showing films shot on 35 millimeter. It's a direct stand against digital, a commitment to the physical experience of film.
And he didn't stop there. He bought the Vista Theater recently, too.
Yep, in 2021. Same intention. Yeah. Keep it running as a first-run theater, but only showing movies projected on actual film. He's putting his money where his mouth is when it comes to preserving the format.
Okay, this leads us neatly into the big thing hanging over his career right now. The countdown. This self-imposed limit of exactly 10 films.
It's such a Tarantino move, isn't it? Curating his own legacy down to the exact number of entries. His reasoning is pretty interesting, too.
He doesn't want to end on a dud, basically.
Right. He talks about avoiding the horrible last movie that contained a great director's filmography. He said ending on a decent movie is rare, and ending on a good movie is kind of phenomenal. He's shooting for phenomenal, trying to craft this perfect, finished set.
And just to clarify the count, Kill Bill counts as one film, volumes 1 and 2 together?
Correct, which makes Once Upon a Time in Hollywood from 2019 his 9th. He's got one left in the chamber.
The pressure on that 10th film must be immense. And he had one planned, right? The Movie Critic.
He did. Set in 1977, about a guy reviewing movies for a porn mag. Sounded very Tarantino-esque, very cinephile-centric. But then he pulled the plug.
Shelved his final film. Why?
He said he was really excited about the writing phase, but when it came to actually making it, dramatizing it, he just wasn't feeling it. He admitted he wasn't really that excited about dramatizing what I wrote.
Wow. So the commitment to quality, or maybe just his personal connection to it, overruled the deadline.
Seems like it. He wasn't going to force it just to hit the number 10. He'd rather wait and get it right, even if it means delaying the final chapter.
So what's he doing instead, if not the 10th film right now?
Well, he's talked about wanting to write a stage play and generally just taking his time, letting the right idea for the final film come to him, maybe waiting at least a year, which fits with how he approaches writing anyway.
Right. He talks about screenwriting starting as novel writing for him.
Yeah. He drafts extensive prose first.
Yeah.
Gets deep into the characters and world, almost like writing a novel, then formats it as a screenplay.
Believes it helps the characters emerge fully formed.
Exactly. Gives them that depth, that backstory, which fuels the dialogue. And this literary side, it's become a really significant part of his output lately.
The book deal with HarperCollins.
Yeah. A 2-book deal. First was the novelization of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in 2021, which wasn't just the script. It added backstory, changed perspectives, a companion piece, really.
And then Cinema Speculation.
His film history book came out in 2022. Essays on 70s New Hollywood cinema, mostly. Deep dives into films and filmmakers he loves. Really successful, too.
And he's gone back to his roots with the podcast.
Video Archives podcast, yeah. With Roger Avery, his old video store buddy. They just watch old tapes, talk about movies they rented out back in the day. It's like full circle, the curator and the creator coming together again.
His strong opinions have even gotten him official critic status, right?
On Rotten Tomatoes, yeah, since 2020. And his takes are pure Tarantino, championing stuff like Ishtar, saying Psycho the Second is better than Hitchcock's original. He's never going to just follow the consensus, even as a critic.
And his skepticism about digital projection, that ties into the retirement plan too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. He's been very blunt about not wanting to make films if 35 millimeter disappears entirely. He sees digital as sterile, lacking the magic, says he won't even make it to 60 as a filmmaker in a purely digital world. So the retirement is partly an artistic statement. a stand against how he sees the industry changing.
Okay, so we've talked about the genius, the style, the legacy curation, but you can't discuss Tarantino without discussing the controversies. They're just as much a part of his story.
Definitely. And maybe the longest running one is about his use of racial language, specifically the N-word.
Yeah, that goes way back, particularly the public feud with Spike Lee. Started around Jackie Brown in 97, Lee called out Tarantino's infatuation with the word.
And Tarantino's defense has always been pretty fiery.
Very. It boils down to a writer's right, as he sees it. He insists he should be able to write any character, use any language necessary to make them feel authentic to their world.
I demand the right to tell the truth as I see they are. That kind of thing. Exactly. He argued it was true to the setting of Jackie Brown. He even called Lee's criticism racist for trying to limit him based on his own race. It's a really fundamental disagreement about art, language, and ownership.
And it blew up again with Django Unchained, obviously, given the subject matter.
Oh, yeah. Using that language so frequently in a film about American slavery, hugely polarizing. Spike Lee famously refused to see it, called slavery a Holocaust, not material for a Sergio Leone spaghetti Western.
Though Samuel L. Jackson, who starred in it, defended Tarantino.
Jackson argued it felt authentic to the period and characters. Tarantino maintained he made Jackie Brown, for instance, primarily for black audiences and was just reflecting the world. It's a debate that's never really gone away.
And there's the whole Harvey Weinstein connection. Weinstein was crucial to his early success with Miramax.
Absolutely pivotal, which made the reckoning during the hashtag MeToo movement incredibly difficult and public for Tarantino.
He eventually admitted he knew more than he let on.
Yeah, he gave that quote, "I knew enough to do more than I did." Admitted that both Mira Sorvino, who he dated, and Uma Thurman had told him about Weinstein's advances. It was a painful admission of complicity, or at least inaction.
And how he described Weinstein, a fucked up father figure, that says a lot.
It really does. Captures that complex mix of gratitude, dependency, and ultimate moral horror. Explains the hesitation, maybe, but he did eventually condemn him.
He also had to apologize for some really bad comments about Roman Polanski that resurfaced.
Right, from a 2003 interview where he seemed to downplay Polanski's crime, suggesting the victim wanted to have it. Just awful stuff.
And when confronted later.
He apologized fully in 2018, said he was incorrectly playing devil's advocate just to be provocative, which kind of highlights a recurring theme, right? Prioritizing the edgy statement over maybe thinking through the implications.
That confrontational side comes out a lot, not just with critics, but industry people, talk show hosts.
Oh, yeah. The Denzel Washington clash during Crimson Tide script doctoring over perceived racist dialogue. Though Denzel later said they buried the hatchet. Than the actual physical fight with Don Murphy.
The producer of Natural Born Killers.
Yeah, Murphy wrote some critical stuff about him. Tarantino apparently found him in a restaurant and assaulted him. Ended up in court, had to pay a fine.
And the David Letterman story is wild.
Letterman tells it like Tarantino called him up absolutely furious over some joke Letterman made about an ex-girlfriend, screaming threats like, "I'm gonna beat you to death."
Seriously? Over a joke?
Apparently. Letterman said he only got this really awkward, grudging apology years later when Tarantino needed to promote a film on his show. It just paints a picture of this incredibly volatile personality.
And that volatility definitely extends to journalists who push him.
Famously so. That Channel 4 interview in 2013 where the journalist kept pressing him on the link between movie violence and real violence.
He completely lost it. "I'm not your slave. I'm not a monkey."
Yeah, just shut down the whole line of questioning with extreme anger. And more recently, at Cannes, when asked if Margot Robbie had too few lines in Once Upon a Time, he just flatly said, "I reject your hypothesis." He does not like his artistic choices being questioned.
Finally, his very public stance on police brutality, that caused a huge storm.
It really did. October 2015, he attended a rally in New York, spoke very passionately.
Calling murder, murder, and murderers, murderers.
Exactly. I'm a human being with a conscience. When I see murder, I cannot stand by. Very strong words.
Which led to police unions calling for a boycott of The Hateful Eight.
Immediately. NYPD union, others across the country. It was a serious backlash, potentially hurting the film's release.
So he had to walk it back a bit.
He clarified, yeah. Said all cops are not murderers. And that being at an anti-brutality protest didn't make him anti-police. He insisted he was talking about specific cases, citing names like Eric Garner, Tamir Rice. But it was a clear instance where his activism directly clashed with his business. Hashtag tag outro.
So looking back at everything, Quentin Tarantino's career is just this incredible story, isn't it? The ultimate film geek who studied the masters and then became one himself.
Absolutely. Built this legacy through homage, yes, but also real innovation. And all alongside this, shall we say, very colorful and controversial public persona.
He's definitely a unique force, highly studied, critically lauded. I remember reading he was the most studied director in the UK at one point.
Yeah, back in 2013. And yet, constantly generating debate. But you can't deny the critical peak, winning all four major U.S. Critics Awards for Pulp Fiction. L.A., National Board of Review, New York, National Society. First director ever to do that, just cemented his status.
And now here he stands right on the edge of this self-declared retirement. One film left.
One shot to stick the landing to avoid that horrible last movie he fears. And we know he's willing to scrap ideas like The Movie Critic if they don't feel absolutely right for that final statement.
The pressure must be unbelievable. It's not just got to be a good film. It has to somehow cap off this entire meticulously curated 10-film arc.
It's the ultimate narrative challenge for him. Can he control this final chapter as perfectly as he controls his scripts?
So the big question for all of us watching is, will this immense pressure to deliver the perfect ending be the one story he can't quite script? Or will Tarantino, the master curator, pull off one last masterpiece, sealing his 10-film legacy exactly as planned?
That's the cliffhanger, isn't it? We'll just have to wait and see what he delivers.
That's our deep dive for today. Thanks for joining us.
We'll see you next time.